So we're continuing with the seventh commandment, and I've taken out of the catechism the small section on work ethics, really. There's no way I've got any special expertise on this matter, but I'm presenting to you what I've discovered from reading and then the encyclicals of the Pope and various things like that. So it'll be fairly simple, I imagine, but it might still be helpful, perhaps even informative. There are three theories in the encyclical literature, anyhow, concerning the way that work should be organised. One is called, and you may be happy with the title, extreme liberalism. Extreme liberals defend the freedom of individuals to unrestricted private property and to the pursuit of individual interest in a market which is free from government interference. That opinion is alive and well. They hold that it's the market which should stimulate and regulate the production and distribution of goods and wealth according to the law of supply and demand. In its extreme form, this theory supports, and now I quote from John Paul II's encyclical Centesimus Annus of 1991, in its extreme form, this theory supports self-love, which leads to an unbridled affirmation of self-interest and which refuses to be limited by any demand of justice. I think that's a fair statement of the extreme view. There's another contrary extreme view, which is in the literature, and it's called extreme socialism. Extreme socialists reject all right of personal ownership of the means of production. They insist on state ownership and regulation of production and distribution, and on the state being controlled by the party. This is extreme communism, which we're familiar with, which alone knows how to direct the state for the ultimate good of the workers. How alive and well that opinion is today, I'm not sure, but it was alive and well. In the light of the collapse of communism in East Europe, it's of value to recall the words of Leo XIII, 1891, Rerum Novarum, warning the world not to see in the removal of personal ownership a solution to the grave social injustices of his day. And I quote, and this is also quoted 100 years later by Pope John Paul II in Centesimus Annus, which means 100 years. It's 100 years after this encyclical. To remedy these wrongs, and he's talking about the unjust distribution of wealth and the poverty of the workers, the socialists encourage the poor person's envy of the rich and strive to do away with private property, contending that individual possession should become the common property of all. But their contentions are so clearly powerless to end the controversy that, were they carried into effect, the working person would be the first to suffer. They are, moreover, emphatically unjust, for they would rob the lawful possessor, distort the functions of the state, and create utter confusion in the community. I would have thought fairly long-sighted view of the defects of extreme communism. John Paul II adds, where self-interest is violently suppressed, it is replaced by a burdensome system of bureaucratic control, which dries up the wellsprings of initiative and creativity. The third medium position, which I imagine most of us would hold, it's with a lot of variations, it's called here reform capitalism and democratic socialism, which is a fairly wide ambit, but it's not at the extremes. Reform capitalists and democratic socialists recognize the importance of personal ownership and of government policies which care for the common good. For legislation governing labor, for welfare programs, and for legislation that frees the market from monopolistic control by large corporations. I would imagine in Australia that all the parties would somehow fit in there, while they would have varying emphases, but then at neither extreme. So that might set the setting for some of the things I want to share with you. So we move then, having looked at those three simplistically defined positions, to the contributions of Christian spirituality to the principles governing work. There's no one Christian answer to the complex problems of economic policy. These have to be worked out by those in touch with the actual dynamic and changing circumstances. But Christianity does alert us to certain principles that need to be kept in mind. Last week I showed you that rather large compendium of the church's social teaching, hundreds of pages of it. So there's massive amount of material in there that's come through the Catholic intellectual tradition for the last 100 and more years, which applies to this. So that, but it can only give principles, as you'd appreciate, wouldn't you, that once you get into this situation with everything changing so rapidly, you need very alert economists and politicians and lawyers to be able to get the balance right between private property, private ownership, and the common good. So here's a statement from Paul VI now. Octogesima adveniens. And if you know your Latin, the coming of the 80th year. And it's still, see, 1971, it's still going back to Rerum Novarum, which was 1891. So it's the 80th year since that publication, and that's what he entitled his encyclical. And he says this. See if you agree with it or whether it helps you in your thinking. The Spirit of the Lord, who animates mankind renewed in Christ, continually breaks down the horizons within which our understanding likes to find security, and the limits to which our activity would willingly restrict itself. There dwells within people a power which urges them to go beyond every system and every ideology. He continues, at the heart of the world there dwells the mystery of men and women discovering themselves to be God's sons and daughters in the course of an historical and psychological process in which constraint and freedom, as well as the weight of sin and the breath of the Spirit, alternate and struggle for the upper hand. The dynamic of the Christian faith here triumphs over the narrow calculations of egoism. Animated by the power of the Spirit of Jesus Christ, the Saviour of mankind, and upheld by hope, Christians involve themselves in the building up of the human city, one that is to be peaceful, just, a community of sisters and brothers, and acceptable as an offering to God. In fact, the expectation of a new earth must not weaken, but rather stimulate our concern for cultivating this. For here grows the body of a new human family, a body which even now is able to give some kind of foreshadowing of the new age. Language is a bit abstract perhaps, but he's encouraging the building of a Christian community which is free to think justly and to build for the common good a community that's loving and just and so on. That's our obligation, but also our privilege. John Paul II, to conclude this introductory part, in his Centesimus Annus, that's 1991, writes, "It's on the level of our understanding of ourselves and of our destiny that the Church's specific and decisive contribution to true culture is to be found." And I'll just pause there. We'll now move to a heading which I've called "Workers Should Not Act or Be Treated Other Than as Persons." Totally obvious, but it doesn't always happen in the workplace, in any community. And these, again, these are all quotations from encyclicals. These are from that beautiful encyclical of Paul VI, Populorum Progressio, The Development of Peoples. And he writes, just again, it's just to inform us and perhaps stimulate our thinking. "The Church, sharing the noblest human aspirations and suffering when it sees them not satisfied, wishes to help people attain their full flowering. And that is why it offers what it possesses as its characteristic attribute, namely, a global vision of the human person and of the human race." You know the word Catholic means universal, all-embracing. So it's certainly the Catholic Christian tradition, which we don't always succeed in doing, to be open and welcoming to everyone and to treat every single human being as sacred and to look after their rights and to love one another. Well, the Pope continues, "Development has to promote the good of every person and the whole person." Whole person, not just economically, but spiritually, intellectually, morally, in every aspect. And he goes on to say, a little later in the same encyclical, "What must be aimed at is complete humanism. And what is that, if not the fully rounded development of the whole person and of every person? A humanism closed in on itself and not open to the values of the Spirit and to God who is their source could achieve apparent success. True, people can organize the world apart from God, but," and now he's quoting the great Dominican theologian de Lubac, "but without God, we can organize it in the end only to mankind's detriment. An isolated humanism is an inhuman humanism." End of quote, and the Pope continues, "There's no true humanism but that which is open to the absolute and is conscious of a vocation which gives human life its true meaning." And could I add there what seems to me really clear? Faith is a choice, isn't it? It's a choice we make. So, we either choose to disbelieve in God, which means, as I see it, we choose to live in a world where we're limited by the capacity of human reason and scientific endeavour to see and improve and so on, even with the best will in the world. So we live in a fairly narrow corridor. The windows are not open to mystery or the sacred, and the length of the corridor is the length of human capacity and achievement and so on, and this world. So that's how we choose to live. And choosing to live there, people can live heroically intelligent, good lives. But let's look at the other choice. The other choice is to believe in God. Now, it's going to depend on what the God is you believe. If the God you believe in, most gods that people believe in before and still are probably dreadful. So you'd be much better without it. It'd be much better to live in the narrow corridor where at least human reason and scientific endeavour was guiding you than to believe in a God who is vicious, male chauvinist, nationalistic, and all the other images of God that are around, and we see them all around us in the world, or they're a substitute for life or for maturity or for anything reasonable, and they cut across reason and we kind of believe what is written in the book even though it's totally unreasonable, and all of that junk, we're better without it. So you close the windows, for heaven's sake, and get back to something reasonable. Or we believe in the God revealed by Jesus. Now we're talking about something. Now we're opening the windows on a mystery that we cannot define, we cannot enclose, we cannot limit, but it's love. It's open to the mystery of love. And when people open the windows to this incredible love, then of course you must use reason. None of that requires us to give our reason away. None of that contradicts science. It can't. It wouldn't want to. Because love is to use our capacities to the best of their ability. So all of this is wonderful, this corridor, but the corridor is full of open windows. And so we're open and alert to the inflowing of grace, of love. And the people who live like that, that I've known anyhow, and I don't know how many there are, but there's a lot, who live like that, live beautiful lives, highly intelligent, highly artistic too, but loving. And they're not the centre of their own energy. They're receiving it. So they're like a sunflower pointing towards the sun, drawing their energy in and listening and attentive and aware that life is a gift and that their life is a gift and intelligence is a gift and science is a gift and art is a gift. A gift has a giver to give it, and that's the one we call, the name doesn't matter, but we call God. It's a beautiful word, but it doesn't matter. It's the sacred, it's the mystery, it's the universal love. So, a bit carried away there, but I think that's what the Pope is, that's what religion, genuine religion is doing. And it has to be checked. Here, we have our checks, science. If it's bad science, you've got to drop it. And if you experiment with it and it's not working and you're going to be honest about it, you have to do something about it. So there's checks and balances in this corridor we're in. Out there, the checks and balances are still there. They are, does the person who believes become more like Jesus? Does the person become more humble, more gentle, more loving, more forgiving, more honest? I don't have to run through the... If a person is becoming more of all those, and if he's a scientist, he'll be a very good scientist because he'll know the limits of science. And if he's a, whatever he is, if he's a husband, wife, father, mother, there's this, so they're the choices, I think, that we make. And he's talking about, people say they're humanist, and some humanists think that means you're atheistic. The Pope is saying, if you're going to be a real humanist, you better be concerned with the human race, with people. And people are eminently mysterious, sacred, vehicles of love to each other. So the best humanism, the only true humanism, is a sacred humanism, a humanism open to God. John Paul II, on this same topic in Centesimus Annus, has this to say. Men and women fulfill themselves by using their intelligence and their freedom. In so doing, they utilize the things of this world as objects and instruments and make them their own. The foundation of the right to private initiative and ownership is to be found in this activity. By means of work, we commit ourselves not only for our own sake, but also for others and with others. Each person collaborates in the work of others and for their good. People work in order to provide for the needs of their family, their community, their nation, and ultimately all humanity. Moreover, they collaborate in the work of their fellow employees, as well as in the work of suppliers and in the customers' use of goods, in a progressively expanding chain of solidarity. The writing's a bit tight, but it's good. I think what he said is very good, but it just needs more time to unpack than we can do here in a small moment, and hopefully I'll put it on the web properly and you can read it again for yourselves later. And in fact, the world is as good as it is because of the massive amount of lovely, good people, aren't there, in all workplaces. And when you go into a workplace where people aren't open to the love, it's pretty tough, isn't it? And you keep meeting people who are working in a bad environment. I've met so many people who work in customs who don't want to work anywhere else. It is so good. They just love it. Don't know what's happened. But someone back then must have set up a feeling or a something. I think I've met 30 people who work in customs over the years, and they all absolutely burst in with happiness. If you work in customs and aren't, you can tell me later and I'll cut it down to 29. So I just think some really good people at some stage set up a system of that attracts people and that keeps a wonderful spirit. And that can be lost quickly, can't it? But it can also be built by you and me where we are in our workplace. Are they nearly all Catholics? Oh, well, there we are. Now we know. Isn't that beautiful? Okay, well, there we are. So everybody take a bow. Thank you for that. Good. So, to conclude this section on the goal of work in families, schools, churches, there we are, and society is persons living in harmony. John Paul II, peace and prosperity are goods which belong to the whole human race. It's not possible to enjoy them in a proper and lasting way if they're achieved and maintained at the cost of other peoples and nations. By violating their rights or excluding them from the sources of well-being. Doesn't it make you sad when you look at the world and see the very rich countries, including our own to some extent, of course, who are that way because of, I guess, trade and. Second point. Persons are subjects and should be respected as graced to be capable of creative contribution through work and have a right to make this contribution. Isn't it wonderful when someone delegates you and says, because they choose you, you have to be well chosen for the, and they delegate you for the job and they say, do it. And of course, there's a bit of oversight and accountability and all that, but it's not as if someone's all the time on your shoulder making you do it their way. It's just so important. You've got to do it. Who said that? I did it my way. What song's that?
Frank Sinatra.
Frank Sinatra, yes. I did it my way. Yeah, that's right. Well, in a way, without being narrow or self-centered, if someone chooses me to be parish priest of Kippax, well, then they've chosen me to do it. So I have to do it my way. And if people don't like the way I do it, then I shouldn't do it their way. I should leave and give it to someone else to do, I think. That's what I would do. But I don't mean stubbornly. We're learning all the time. But if you give someone a job and get them to do it your way, the world's full of people doing that, and it's absolutely uncreative. I think it's just dreadful, and it's not respectful of the person's creative energy, ideas, etc. So with all the accountability that's necessary, do it your way. Here's the Pope, anyhow, in Laborum Exercens, saying, we must act against unemployment, this is about giving your contribution, which in all cases is an evil, and which, when it reaches a certain level, can become a real social disaster. And a system that's set up to have unemployment, to keep costs high, or whatever it might be, the complicated reasons, is unjust. Persons are not individuals, but we are interdependent. And this should be obvious in our work. But I'm reading a book at the moment, or our parish council is reading it with, we're doing it together, called Jesus Today by Albert Nolan, the author of Jesus Before Christianity, which he wrote some 40 years ago, I think. And he's got a good chapter in there. It's quite a good book, really. Chapter 2 is really good about the culture we're in is individualistic. It's about the individual. And every other culture in the world, the simpler cultures, look at us with amazement. Because to be an individual in their culture is to have an enormous suffering. Because they know, we know, that you become who you are through communion. I started my life stuck on my mother's placenta. Like you're always drawing and you're always in communion. And then when you popped out, you went straight for the breast. I mean, you just need connection. And it's connected, we flower in good connections. Isolated, well, you look at the problems in our own communities of isolation. Dreadful psychological neuroses can develop out of it. So actually, individualism is a phony. It's a scam. It doesn't work. A person being free, creative, and in communion with others, well, that's what our aim is. I'll just pause again. Just this final page before we take a break on work. Natural resources is the heading. Again, John Paul II. He wrote some magnificent encyclicals on justice in the world. Four or five of them. And this is from Centesimus Annus again. Work is meant to order, organize, orchestrate natural resources in a way that respects nature and recognizes that it is graced. Nature is graced. It's a gift from God every second of our life, gifted, held in existence by God's creative love. So they do this in a way that respects nature and recognizes that it's graced and is a gift for the benefit of all. It is morally wrong, well, they're my words, sorry, now here's John Paul II, to consume the resources of the earth and human life in an excessive and disordered way. I think we're all becoming more aware of that, I am anyhow, in recent years. the earth's being ruined by greed, and it's hard to control because we've got multinational companies and we haven't got a multinational law. We've got the United Nations doing its best. I can't see that it could do much better within the limits that are there, and the limits seem sensible to me in any case, but it can't legislate and rule. It can't control like a government could. So we haven't got a world government, but we've got world economic systems that reach across, and they have immense power. Just take it offshore and put it somewhere else if you don't pay what you've got to pay, or if you don't let us have our water free, and off it goes. So we've got massive problems in this, and we're making some efforts, but they seem minimal to me in any case, because the resources of the earth are being absorbed in excessive and disordered way. The second point, and again I started and then the Pope, I'll quote from Pope John Paul, natural resources are not the product of work. However ownership is organized, they must be used for the benefit of all. And here's the John Paul II. Everything that comes from people throughout the whole process of economic production, whether labour or the whole collection of means of production and the technology connected with these means, meaning the capacity, the capability to use them at work, presupposes these riches and resources of the visible world, riches and resources that we find and do not create. So the goods, we did it last week, the goods of the world are actually for everybody, not for a few. Just a brief word on capital. Capital as means of production is the product of work and should be at the service of workers. Again, John Paul II. Everything that is at the service of work, everything that in the present state of technology, machines, factories, laboratories, computers, constitutes its ever more highly perfected instruments, is the result of work. And he goes on, the only legitimate title to the possession of the means of production, whether this be in the form of private ownership or in the form of collective ownership, is that they should serve labour. And in a later document, the Centesimus Annus, he has this to say about capital. Alienation is found in work when it is organized to ensure maximum returns and profits with no concern whether the worker, through his or her own labor, grows or diminishes as a person. Either through the increased sharing in a genuinely supportive community or through increased isolation in a maze of relationships marked by destructive competitiveness and estrangement in which the person is considered only as a means and not an end. Couple of brief headings. Workers have the right to enjoy the fruit of their work, provided workers remember that they are interdependent members of the community. Another point, workers have the right to co-determine policy in the use of resources. Workers are also co-responsible for their proper use. And this includes one of the basic principles of Catholic social teaching, not only Catholic, but it is Catholic, the principle of subsidiarity. Tasks which can be properly carried out by a lower body should not be performed by a higher one. I have read a lot about this over the years, and I'm becoming more and more convinced of it, that the one that makes the decision should be the person closest to the effects of that decision. If I make a decision as parish priest, and I don't even know what happens because of the decision, I'm not good or ill, I'm not suffering the consequences, that's not a good system. I can have points of view, of course, and you can have a certain leadership and you can check this and do all the things you have to do when your hand's on the tiller, whether you like it or not. You've got to do something. But surely the best person to decide how to run the mums and bubs is going to be the mum with the bubs. Or the mums with the bubs, isn't it? I mean, so you've got to consult them, talk about them, and if there's difference of opinion, work it through, and then finally a decision needs to be made. But better that be... You can't do it without the people right on the spot. We've just been fixing up in the parish hour, cleaning of the church and downstairs. And it's more complicated than you might believe. Fairly big place. So I've just been ordering things to put soap in them, you know, these things to stick on the wall and things to clean toilets. And so you'd think a priest should do something far more spiritual, I thought. In any case... But it's all part of making a family happy, isn't it? If it's not done, it's not done, and others can, it's all that. But, I mean, just talking with the... I was talking the other night with one of the ones who's doing a lot of the organising work. He gave me some terrific ideas, of course. And so you follow them through. The point I'm making, anyhow, is enough on that, is the principle of subsidiarity, which religiously poses immense problems. Why am I in a church which for the last 150 only years the local bishop is decided from Rome? What is going on? How inefficient for a start. How, I would almost go to the limit of saying stupid, except that I'm being recorded and I've got to be careful about what I say on record. But what a kind of a system is that? Because, okay, I don't mean they shouldn't have a say, and their wisdom should be taken into consideration, and a prophetic statement to say, look, it seems to me that what Canberra needs is this, or Sydney needs is this, or whatever. But the actual, with all that, you know, advice and spiritual leadership and encouragement and prophetic kind of stuff, leave the decision to the Sydney Church, so that having been... or Canberra Church, or whatever, having been advised and all that, and you know what I mean, there's checks and balances. I'm not going to organise the church any better than it is now myself, but surely there's a question here that needs asking, because we're the community, and we're likely to know the kind of... And if there's a leader already, I'll tell you this story, because you've got to hear it. There's nothing to... Archbishop of Milan, Ambrose. Do you know the story about how Ambrose was selected the Archbishop of Milan? Some of you do and some of you don't. Well, if some of you don't, you can hear it again. It's a wonderful story. Milan, we're going back to the 370s, something like that, AD, 4th century. Rome was a bit of a backwater at that stage. The real important centre was up at Milan. St. Augustine, who was from what is now... Algeria, really, just across the border from Tunisia, but he'd gone to Carthage, which is in Tunisia, what we call Tunisia today, and then he went up to Rome, then he went to Milan. So he's part of the scene. Just before he arrived, some years, they had the Greek church ran Milan, and there was a Roman church too, and they're both in collaboration, but the language was different and the systems were different rites and so on. So when the archbishop or the bishop died, they had to elect another bishop. So they're in the cathedral, you imagine yourself, they're all there, they're electing their own bishop. What a sensible idea. So democracy, eat your heart out. There they are in there electing their bishop, and it turned into a riot. Like they were fighting each other, there were biffs, there were not only were the swords were drawn, but they were so interested in it that they were taking sides, and this battle was going on. They had to call the police. The head of the police happened to be a man called Ambrose, who was a catechumen in the Roman church. He'd learnt about the Beatitudes, he'd probably met some beautiful Christians, he thought, isn't Christianity beautiful, and he's studying it, and he's interested in it, and he wants to become a Christian, and that happens to be the head of police. So he comes in to stop this riot. And he's so appalled at what he's seeing that he gets up on the rostrum and he bangs whatever his authority thing on the ground and rants at the people for 15 minutes about, what are you doing to each other? What is Christian? He just gave it to them. This is beautiful. A little 15-year-old kid in the second said, Ambrose for bishop. And it took the whole lot of them, because he's a leader, you see. They had a leader, and they saw him. I said, right, he was baptised. I haven't got the exact figures. I think he was baptised on Thursday, ordained on Saturday, and bishop on Sunday. But I like that system. Now we go back to what we're talking about. But it is on the subject of subsidiarity in any case. Keeping close to the things. Because that's a great check against power. And power does corrupt anybody. In a position of power, it's dangerous. So, and it's good and it's very important to have power, to use it properly. Which reminds me of another distraction, that wonderful film. If you've got it in you on video, I want to see it some again. Ryan's Daughter. I'd love to see it again. Has anyone got it in a video? Oh, lend it to me, Mari. Lend it to me. Because I've been looking for it for years. Because I just love the scene of the priest when they're there. They were going to tar and something, some woman who'd committed adultery, hadn't she, with somebody? I've forgotten the exact story. They were going to. And they're about to do it, and the priest comes up and he lands a keen hit on the bloke running it and knocks him to the ground. And the bloke says, you're abusing your priestly power. And he says, that's what it's for. Well, I thought, so having shown you how much I abuse power and love it, it needs control. Back to our topic. Now you've had two distractions. Underdevelopment and the sin of overdevelopment. How can you say much about this except briefly? Paul the VI, for both nations and for individuals, avarice is the most evident form of moral underdevelopment. I just think it's a great line. That's why I've got handing it to you. There's a lot of non-adult behaviour going on in the political world, isn't there, at high places. And there's a lot of lack of development, not just out there, here too, in the church as well. And moral underdevelopment is power, greed, abuse of it. Here's John Paul II again, just to see whether it enlightens you a bit. To the economic and social indices of underdevelopment, other indices must be added which are equally negative and indeed even more disturbing, beginning with the cultural level. These are illiteracy, the difficulty of or impossibility of obtaining higher education. When I was chaplain at the university, during the Whitlam years, university was free. I wish we could do it again. I don't know why we can't, but I don't know why we can't. Others would perhaps know. I wish we could again. And students used to demonstrate, and students used to sit around on the lawn outside the library and discuss and get angry. And it was nice being among them, because there's a lot to be angry about and a lot to discuss about it. Gradually during the 70s, when I was there as chaplain, it got harder and harder to do any of those things because the way they organised the university and so on. And then now I've got this can't be right, but I have a general feeling that the university is a means to employment, largely, when it should be the leisure to think differently and to explore and to make mistakes, but also to get a bit of youthful passion, to get our system rejuvenated. Anyhow. Illiteracy, the difficulty or impossibility of obtaining higher education, the inability to share in the building of one's own nation, the various forms of exploitation and of economic, social, political and even religious oppression of the individual and his or her rights, discrimination of every type, especially the exceptionally odious form based on difference of race. We got a letter from our provincial just during the week. The MSCs have been in the Northern Territory since the beginning of the, well over 100 years. And it was about, he had a meeting with some of his advisors and others on our own MSC involvement in the Northern Territory. And it's quite a good statement. And there's a lovely statement in by Pat Dodson, who was the only Aboriginal priest in the Catholic Church. And what does that say about our systems of ordination? If you can only get one Aboriginal Catholic priest in all the years of mission work, we've got it wrong. If Paul, imagine, going for the first mission of Paul in southern Turkey, Galatia, imagine if Paul had to have sent somebody off to be there to Jerusalem for 4 years training in Greek, Latin, whatever else, before they could come back and lead the community. No, on his way back he said, Bill, you lead the community, William. Bill said, oh, no, you can't, go for it. So Bill became the leader of the community, the priest. He was ordained, like that's how it worked, because they found a leader and gave it to him. That had to work like that, didn't it? Because, and it did work, and if it hadn't have done like that, it would have just been hopelessly collapsed. So, I've become aware, maybe you too, that Australia is... You don't have to scratch very deep before you quite find a lot of racism, you know. But it hasn't ever been exploded into the obvious places that other countries have. But it's not far below the surface in many communities. And that's to our shame. But there seems to be a breath of fresh air coming into it all. I hope it becomes a bigger one. I had a brother, a priest, who died 15 years ago now at the tender age of 60, and he worked in the Aboriginal mission all his life, and that was a privilege for me to know him and to see how much he was loved there and how much he loved that and what he learnt there about human values and family. And when he was dying, I know I was looking after him. I suppose you could say I was looking after him. Anyway, he died, so I didn't do it too well. No, I mean, I was his carer kind of thing. And... we used to get these phone calls from where he used to be a missionary up in the Tiwi country of Bathurst Island, and they'd always say, how are you, and how are your brothers and sisters? They'd never met them, these phone calls, but very real, you know, like people stuff. And they wanted him to be buried up there, and he didn't want to die. He was kind of resisting death, which is probably a good thing to do, really, till you die. So, but when he finally came round to be ready, which was not long before he did die, and I was hopefully trying to help him on that little bit of the journey, or that big journey, he said, well, what should I do? And I said, John, if you're buried in Australia, I said, I'll probably never visit your grave. I hate to say it, but I haven't visited Mum's grave, I haven't visited Dad's grave, I don't even know exactly where they are buried, you know, because of life's taken me into different states and I'm somewhere else. I said, well, for what it's worth, we love you, but I'm not the only one in the family who hasn't kind of made a thing about this. So I have a feeling that in our culture, where you're buried's not a big issue, whereas in their culture, and we gave you to the missions 50 years ago, in their culture, if you're buried there, your spirit is still there, your mission goes on there, what you gave them is still part of their world, and they want you to be buried there. So... if you call it advice or a direction, I don't care, get buried in Bathurst Island. So I said, oh, okay. So I said, yes, he'll be buried in Bathurst Island. Someone else had to pay the airfare, but anyhow, that doesn't... So, and he was. I wasn't able to go, sadly, because of other reasons, but my other brother did. So... under... Oh, John Paul II about overdevelopment. The overdevelopment which consists in an excessive availability of every kind of material goods for the benefit of certain social groups. How do you decide which dog biscuits to buy when there's a whole row of them? I mean, dogs are beautiful things, I know, but it's massive, isn't it? And you get the cheapest. Well done. Well done. Well, you might know, you might want special nutrition. I have Vitabrits, 3 Vitabrits every morning of my life. Boring, boring, boring. And that's breakfast for me. It saves you making decisions. But when you walk in to find the Vitabrits, there's a whole, isn't there, like from here to the back wall of different kind of cereals. Just amazing. Well, maybe that's an excessive availability of the kind of material goods for the benefit of certain social groups. Easily makes people slaves of possession and immediate gratification, with no other horizon than the multiplication or continual replacement of the things already owned with others still better. This is the so-called civilization of consumption or consumerism, which involves so much throwing away and waste. An object already owned but now superseded by something better is discarded, with no thought of its possible lasting value in itself, nor of some other human being who is poorer. A very complicated area, I think. But he's saying something valuable, isn't he, to all of us? Just another heading, another reflection that might stir something. Technology is a problem only when it's misused. This is John Paul II again. Technology facilitates work, perfects, accelerates, and augments it. It leads to an increase in the quantity of things produced by work and in many cases improves their quality. However, it's also a fact that in some instances technology can cease to be mankind's ally and become almost our enemy, as when the mechanization of work supplants us, taking away all personal satisfaction and the incentive to creativity and responsibility, when it deprives many workers of their previous employment, or when, through exalting the machine, it reduces people to the status of slaves. Another thought in relation to work ethic. There is need for effective central planning to promote justice and to offset injustice. And again, I'm quoting from John Paul II. The concept of indirect employer includes both persons and institutions of various kinds, and also collective labour contracts and the principles of conduct which are laid down by these persons and institutions and which determine the whole socio-economic system or are its result. In order to meet the danger of unemployment and to ensure employment for all, the agents defined as indirect employer must make provision for overall planning with regard to the different kinds of work by which the economic and cultural life of a given society is shaped. They must also, the Pope continues, give attention to organising that work in a correct and rational way. These are obviously very general principles. In the final analysis, this overall concern weighs on the shoulders of the state. but it cannot mean one-sided centralization by the public authorities. Instead, what is in question is a just and rational coordination within the framework of which the initiative of individuals, free groups, and local work centres and complexes must be safeguarded, keeping in mind what has been said with regard to the subject character of human labour. And once again, I'm sure all political parties are trying to do this as best they can from their own point of view. In our country, in any case. Centesimus annus, again, John Paul II writes, a society of free work, of enterprise and of participation is not directed against the market, but demands that the market be appropriately controlled by the forces of society and by the state, so as to guarantee that the basic needs of the whole of society are satisfied. And again, it continues, the common good is not simply the sum total of particular interests. Rather, it involves an assessment and integration of those interests on the basis of a balanced hierarchy of values. Ultimately, it demands a correct understanding of the dignity and rights of the person. We go back to that all the time, don't we? And so a Jesus-centered spirituality and a Jesus-centered church is always treating you as sacred. And now when we sin, we sin, and that has to be corrected by us and with the help of others. But that never takes away from the inner sanctity of the mystery of each individual person. And if we're aware of that and we approach people in that way, like Moses approaching the burning bush, take our shoes off and enter in a sacred way, the workplace would be a wonderful place and governments would be wonderful governments, and they would control greed on behalf of those who do not treat people as sacred. We have to protect ourselves against that. And that needs good law and good carrying out of law. So now, by way of four pages of conclusion for this brief summary statement of some of the principles that govern our thinking about work and labour. Every situation must be examined carefully by the people who are involved in it and appropriate direction set. The word economy means the order, nomos in Greek, of the house, oikos. So the ordering of the house, house meaning household, or the larger household of the state. So economy are those laws that govern the organisation of a community, of the house. We must assist each other in recognising injustice and alienation in all our institutions. We must distance ourselves from individualism and work together in solidarity in the struggle to reverence the person and respect nature. This will require an intelligently and sensitively organized planning of the economy. Something that Pope Leo XIII, way back in 1891, insisted on. While organizing work to achieve a greater participation of the workers, with the mind, heart, soul and strength, you shall love the Lord your God with all of that. So involving the mind of the worker, the heart of the worker, the soul of the worker and the physical strength of the worker. In all aspects of work, remembering that the collective interest of one group must recognise that the interests of all workers at all levels must be respected, and in a way that advances the cause of the unemployed. Paul VI in Octogesima Adveniens, 1971, writes, I've got two pages of quote from him. See what you think of this. Let each of us examine ourselves to see what we've done up to now and what we ought to do. It's not enough to recall principles, state intentions, point to crying injustices, and utter prophetic denunciations. These words will lack real weight unless they're accompanied for each individual by a livelier awareness of personal responsibility and by effective action. It's too easy to throw back on others responsibility for injustices if at the same time one doesn't realise how each one shares in it personally and how personal conversion is needed first. This basic humility will rid action of all inflexibility and sectarianism. It will also avoid discouragement in the face of a task which seems limitless in size. The Christian's hope comes primarily from the fact that we know that the Lord is working with us in the world, continuing in his body, which is the church, and through the church in the whole of mankind, the redemption which was accomplished on the cross and which burst forth in victory on the morning of the resurrection. This hope springs also from the fact that the Christian knows that others are at work to undertake actions of justice and peace, working for the same ends. For beneath an outward appearance of indifference, in everyone's heart there is a will to live in brotherhood and sisterhood and a thirst for justice and peace which is to be expanded. Pope Paul VI had a really lovely mind and a lovely heart. He's a wonderful, saintly man. I must have told you, or I presume I have at one stage, but Brescia was where he was born, in northern Italy, across from Venice. And in the Cathedral of Brescia, there's this beautiful statue. I've only seen it twice. Once years ago when I was accompanying as a chaplain the Ursuline Sisters, who were founded in that area, Brescia, by Angela Merici. And the other time was last year when I was with a couple. And this is, an amazing example of how your mind plays tricks on you, because I told them all about this statue of Paul VI. I was absolutely certain that this is what it was like. I didn't have the slightest doubt. And I said, what you're going to see is this bronze statue of Paul VI, the Pope, bent over like that, double, and on his shoulder is the building, a building that represents the church. It's the church that's weighing down on Paul VI's shoulders, and he looks, it's really a tragic thing, because he was a brilliant person who was overwhelmed by the Vatican that surrounded him. So that's the picture I showed them. We went to a lot of trouble to get to Brescia with these two friends. We got there just as Italy goes to sleep at 1 o'clock. So we had to wait till 3 o'clock or 3:30 till the church opened. And I knocked on doors and thought, surely they'd let Australians who've come all the way. But no, there's no chance. So siesta had to go on. 3:30 we go in, and I search for the statue and find it. And someone had changed the statue. Someone had taken something off. They'd removed the church off Paul the Sixth's shoulders. It was the same statue bent over without the church. So I went up to the person who was running the sacristan. Oh no, he'd been there for 30 years. There never was a church on the shoulders. I had invented the church. You know, like when I saw it, to me, I knew that it was the church that was the weight. So I actually saw it and had told the story and carried it in my mind for all those years. And I was completely wrong. Like, wrong but right, you know. And to me, it was a really good example of how the knowledge is... There's a lot of stuff going inside all of us, isn't there, that helps create what we know. And it can often be wrong. Wrong at different levels. So. But anyhow, so I had to be satisfied. I was just amazed that there was nothing there that I'd seen. But I'd seen it here. Not with my eyes. Dear Paul. Anyhow, that's Paul the Sixth. So conclude now with this statement from John Paul II, and this is the end of anything I can offer you on this topic of work. There's no justification for despair or pessimism or inertia, all of which are quite possible, aren't they? We look at the weight of the size of it all. We might as well sit down and watch the days of our lives and go to bed and, you know, do... I presume that's still on TV, is it? Or it used to be hundreds of years ago. And still there. God help us. Okay. So there's no justification for watching days, for despair or pessimism or inertia. Though it be with sorrow, it must be said that just as one may sin through selfishness and the desire for excessive profit and power, one may also be found wanting with regard to the urgent needs of multitudes of human beings submerged in conditions of underdevelopment through fear, this is our fear, indecision, and basically through cowardice, in thinking there's nothing we can do.